You're listening to Radio Area.
Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, you vocal, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I bear orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be. In the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One word more for signal token, whistle up the marching tune. For your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon. With your pike upon your shoulder.
Greetings from the Northwest homeland, comrades. The date is Thursday, August 1st, 2019. I'm Andy Donner, and you're listening to Radio Free Northwest.
For the blessed warming light, farmers passed along the valleys like the banshee's lonely croon, and a thousand blades were flashing at the rising of the moon. At the rising of the moon, at the rising of the moon.
Comrades, for this week's Radio Free Northwest rerun, I've pulled October 18th, 2012. We recently had a question about Northwest Front Canada, and this episode deals with that. I'm also enjoying the compare and contrast thing I'm doing with pulling relevant episodes from years gone by, because there's material about grand juries here, and I can't help but note the news about Jerry Nadler trying to do an end run around the law to get a hold of the Mueller collusion grand jury material. It'll be fun to see how that plays out.
Okay, before I start ranting and raving about Obama and Netanyahu and whatnot, while I'm thinking about it, I'm going to start out this week with a little basic instruction on the subject of grand juries, because it's come up again recently. Now, sometime last week, I emailed an article out to the Northwest Revolution List about how our friends in the silk suits are sending some little Miss Organic tree-hugging type to prison because she won't testify in front of a federal grand jury in Portland, Oregon. Now, this has nothing to do with us, it's these hippy-dippy Cascadia idiots, but it's an interesting example of how the regime habitually uses institutional terrorism to force human beings to submit to tyranny and grovel before them. Like so much that this power structure abuses, grand juries began back in England under the Magna Carta, when they were originally intended as a safeguard for the civil liberties of individuals, to force government officials like magistrates and the local squire or baron to produce some kind of evidence before charging an individual with a crime, not just arbitrarily throwing him into the dungeon, and I do mean dungeon back in those days. Now, I might add that under the 2006 draft constitution of the Northwest American Republic, we have retained the grand jury system for the same reason. Like so many more things, such as universal health care and national service, the grand jury system will work when it is applied in a society that is all white and productive and as free of corruption as it is possible to make things in a human context. But in a ghoulish perversion of the original intent of the law, prosecutors in America have twisted the grand jury into an instrument to oppress the descendants of the very people who created America in the first place and whose traditions gave us that law. Not an uncommon occurrence in this country. Grand juries are abused by the government in two ways. First off, when someone is arbitrarily arrested and charged with a crime by the police or the district attorney, in most cases, the law requires a preliminary hearing to see if there is sufficient evidence to proceed to trial. In other words, actual evidence of guilt that must be presented publicly in open court, and it can be subjected to open examination and cross-examination by defense counsel who are present. Since more and more people are being arrested these days on charges that are basically politically or economically motivated horseshit, prosecutors want to avoid this for obvious reasons. This is what the Jew Michael Schlosser did to the Greensboro Men in 1979. He knew he was dealing with what was probably the most clear-cut case of self-defense in the history of American jurisprudence. And a preliminary hearing would have established that the Communist Workers' Party were the aggressors who had opened fire with guns first. And so, in order to charge the Greensboro 16, he snuck into a grand jury the day before the preliminary was scheduled, and he got his indictments so that he could keep the men in jail without bond for another 10 months in the hopes that at least one of them would crack and plead guilty. Schlosser wanted to find some way to get all the men to plead guilty to something so he could cover up the presence and active participation of not one, not two, but three, count 'em, three government informants in the case. Now, the second way in which the grand jury system is habitually abused as an instrument of personal and political persecution by evil government lawyers and secret policemen is by the abuse of its investigative powers. Now, anytime the regime wants to break someone or force them to talk to the secret police, they summon them in front of the grand jury. In essence, grand juries are a potent weapon in the creation of the American surveillance state because they can be used to force Americans to become informers. And even with all the electronic eavesdropping and spy cameras, the basis of the surveillance state is still the human informer. The Stasi in East Germany once employed 1/3 of the entire population of the country as informers on the other 2/3. You are not entitled to an attorney in a grand jury room. They can subpoena you and put you in prison without charge or trial if you fail to appear. Many people don't understand that contempt charges, that's contempt of court, contempt of a grand jury, and contempt of Congress, do in fact allow the government to imprison people at will, which is what theoretically isn't supposed to happen in America. And with a little legal razzle-dazzle, the government can keep people in prison almost indefinitely without charge, without trial, and without an attorney. You don't get your rights back unless and until you are formally charged with something, and there's no way you can force them to do that from a prison cell. The only way that can happen is if you have access to an attorney on the outside who can file a habeas corpus motion for you. Now, if you have no money and no friends or family on the outside who know where you are and who have money to hire an attorney, then you're screwed. Even if they do hire one, the judge and the prosecutor and the court don't have to allow that attorney to see his client. A contempt charge basically suspends the Constitution. A lot of people still think this kind of thing can't happen in this country. Yes, it can. Recent history is replete with examples. And not that these rights are guaranteed anymore anyway. Under the Patriot Act, the Military Commissions Act of 2006, or the National Defense Authorization Act of 2011, basically, all that needs to happen is some U.S. attorney needs to declare that your case is a so-called terrorist case, and poof, no more Constitution. The secret police and the system can do anything and everything they want to a dissident or a political opponent of Obama's, up to and including torture and murder. And it's all legally sanctioned and even approved of in some government circles. Ask Matt Hale, the only white American citizen to be imprisoned so far under the Patriot Act, or at least the only one that we know of. Oh, that's another thing. You can now legally be held incommunicado. There are thousands of Muslims who disappeared after 9/11 who are still missing, and no one knows where they are. Presumably in Guantanamo someplace, but who knows? Federal law enforcement agents came in the night and took them away, and then simply ignored any request for further information for 11 years. Their families can't even have them declared legally dead because the government won't tell them anything. Yes, Virginia, it can happen here, and it has. Remember, the biggest advocate of legalized torture after 9/11 was the Jew Alan Dershowitz, who was a professor at the Harvard Law School. But I was talking about the old-fashioned pre-9/11 way with grand juries, which for some reason is what they've decided to do to little Miss Moonbeam down there in Portland, whose real name, by the way, is Leah Lynn Plant. She kind of reminds me of Rowan and Martin's hippy-dippy weather girl, for those of you old coots like me who can remember back that far. Now, what they're doing to her illustrates another aspect of grand jury abuse. Once they get you in that room, they don't have to stick to the subject, whatever crime it is they claim to be investigating. They can ask you about anything they want. They can ask you for background information on people you know, information that you have already refused to divulge to the secret police, as is your legal right to do. Now, this is what appears to be happening in the hippy-dippy girl's case. In a grand jury, there is no longer any right to remain silent. The excuse that they gave for dragging Leah Plant in front of the grand jury was that some people broke some windows here in Seattle last May. No kidding, that's what it amounts to. Massive amounts of tax dollars are being spent to find out who committed some acts of petty vandalism. Now, remember what I once said about how anti-terrorism in this country is an industry, and if there are no terrorists, then there can be no anti-terrorists? Now, fortunately for everyone involved, the lefties in this country aren't any better at revolution than we are. Apparently, Ms. Plant wasn't even in Seattle that day, and nobody in the government even bothers to claim that she was. Basically, what they want to do is force her to talk to the FBI, to give them information and update their databases with background on all her hippy-dippy friends. She's not even suspected of a crime herself, hadn't been charged with anything. The FBI simply wants her to turn informer, and she won't. Now, that's another right that we no longer have in this country. The right to not be an informer. The FBI cannot legally force you to talk to them, but they can and will use a grand jury to do so. Now, the way it works is that while you technically do still have your Fifth Amendment right against self-incrimination, if you choose to exercise it, they will offer you, or rather grant you outright, whether you want it or not, immunity from prosecution, and if you still refuse to talk to them, they imprison you for quote-unquote contempt, without trial, without charge, without a right to an attorney. This was how they did it in the days before Guantanamo, and how they still choose to do it sometimes, as in the case of Ms. Plant in Portland. In theory, you can only be imprisoned in a county jail, and only for the length of the grand jury's life, which is 18 months. In actual practice, they'll send you to a real prison or prison camp if they feel like it, and if someone in the power structure wants to continue to terrorize and torture you, when one grand jury expires, they will simply impanel another one and drag you back in front of that one and go through the whole rigmarole again. Technically speaking, you can spend your whole life in prison without charge and without trial. One thing you must always remember is that these people have the power. You do not. They can and will do anything they want to you, and there is nothing that you can do to stop them unless you have money to pay lawyers, or unless you have a dark skin, or you practice certain sexual perversions, and therefore you have powerful friends on the outside who have money and they can hire lawyers. Now, there is, of course, a way we could take their power away from them, but we won't use it because we're too afraid that they might hurt us, and we have been conditioned all our lives to avoid risk and difficulty and not confront and overcome it. Until that changes, they will continue to do whatever the hell they want to us. Anyway, wandering back onto the subject here, the one right that you do still retain in front of a grand jury is the Fifth Amendment, as I've already mentioned. Now, I've already explained to you how they then offer you immunity to force you to become an informer and incriminate anyone and everyone they want incriminated. Oh, did I forget to tell you? You can also be charged with contempt if you don't tell them what they want to hear once immunity is granted, or perjury if they really don't like what you have to tell them. It doesn't matter if you tell them the truth. They don't want the truth. They want your information and your assistance to help them drag other human beings into the mangling machine. I've said it before and I'll say it again. The government and the judicial system in this country is a mangling machine that requires human beings and human blood and bone as fodder. Human beings are the fuel that keeps this evil machine going, and they want your help to drag more people into it, to feed the beast, feed the machine. Now, to be sure, the Fifth Amendment did work for me the one time I myself was ever summoned in front of one of these goddamn things, which was in June of 1981 down in New Orleans over that ridiculous Dominica business. But I think in my case, I was lucky. Number one, they weren't really after me. They were after some people who they believed were behind it all, and whom they never got, by the way. Number two, I think the assistant U.S. attorney in New Orleans who was prosecuting the case was basically a decent guy who knew full well that I hadn't done anything criminal, and that I was only there because FBI agent Richard Goldberg screamed and screamed and screamed that I'd be dragged into it. Now, this man must still have had some scruples about using the law to silence political dissent. Of course, bear in mind this was 31 years ago, and you won't find anybody like that in the system these days. Still, it was a bit of a narrow-run thing, as the Brits say. The trick is that you must claim the Fifth Amendment on everything and not answer a single question, not even give the prosecution the time of day or the weather. I even took the Fifth Amendment when they asked me my name. It's kind of like a long version of the five words, I have nothing to say. When you go into the grand jury room, have it all written out on a 3x5 index card and say nothing else. By the way, if they do grant you immunity, make sure you get what's called full transactional immunity and not something called use or derivative immunity. U.S. attorneys especially are notorious for finding various ways to sneak out of their immunity agreements and put people in prison even after they've cooperated, although you shouldn't be cooperating with them at all. And if you're going to do that, then you have no business listening to this program to begin with. That's one thing, though, that you should bear in mind. You can never, ever trust any government lawyer, any federal agent, or any judge to keep their word. They consider us to be trash and scum who should not exist at all. To them, we are the lowest of the low, worse than drug pushers or child molesters. I've always been amazed at how much these people despise and fear white nationalists, possibly because they know that we secretly speak for millions, and they know that we might win someday and take away their wealth and power. They don't consider any agreement made with us to be in any way binding on them, and they will violate it at the slightest pretext. The word of any attorney or any federal agent or any judge is completely worthless. Trust it, and you will be betrayed without hesitation. Okay, I didn't mean to take up the whole first part of the show with this grand jury stuff, but looks like it did. Now, did you know that there are all kinds of strange little white communities all around the world, scattered remnants of our great age of exploration and colonization in the 18th and 19th centuries? South America has quite a few of these little bits and pieces. Germans in Paraguay, Confederates in Brazil, and believe it or not, almost 50,000 Welsh speakers in Patagonia, the very tip of South America, where Argentina and Chile meet. This is a Welsh air of these people called Mimosa Patagonia, the Song of Patagonia.
Farwell fy hyn ffrindia, mae'r gwynt yn yr hwyliau'r capten yn galw, mae'r angor yn rhydd. Byth mwy caf weld Cymru, fy aelwyd fy'n heili pan fyddaf yn glanio ar ben draw y byd. Gwynteg i'r mimosa i gyrraedd y wladfa, ond Cymro y byddaf hi terfyn fy oes. Farwel fy hyn ffrindiau, rwy'n siŵr gweleisiau pob un a phob peth sydd yn anwyl i mi. Ond erbydd na hiraeth ar ddiwedd y fordaeth, byd gwell sydd yn disgwyl ar ochr drawr llu. Gwynteg i'r mimosa i gyrraedd y wladfa, ond Cymro y byddaf hi terfyn fy oes. Er caled y drafferth, rwy'n siŵr bydd yr anterth werth yr holl aberth all wellaf yn myd. Gobeithiaf am gartref fel hyn brof y mebyd, am lastir oedd gwyrddion mewn ffrwythlon wynfyd. Gwynteg i'r mimosa i gyrraedd y wladfa, ond Cymro y byddaf hi terfyn fy oes. Os trwm bydd yng nghalon, bydd gen i atgofion i'w cofio yn llawen i lenwi fy myron. I godi fy ysbryd, i ddal at fy myreiddwyd am sbarduno pob dydd, am cadw yn llon. Gwynteg i'r mimosa i gyrraedd y wladfa, ond Cymro y byddaf hi terfyn fy oes. Gobeithiaf bydd bywyd yn glid a llawn golyd, a bydd fy hyn mamiaeth yn fyw yn fy nhi, a bydd Dyw yn fy ngwarchod trwy amser dydd ysgod, a gwna fydd anghofio mae Cymro i fi. Gwynteg i'r mimosa i gyrraedd y wladfa, ond Cymro y byddaf hi terfyn fy oes.
In June of 2010, North Idaho attorney Edgar J. Steele was arrested by the FBI on false charges of allegedly hiring a hitman to murder his wife and mother-in-law. The alleged assassin was a man named Larry Fairfax, an FBI informer who had previously been inserted in Steele's home posing as a handyman in order to spy on the Steele family before any of this came up. I should mention that Edgar Steele himself was apparently unaware of that fact as recently as a year ago, according to some of the interview footage you're about to hear. Now, while he was working there, Fairfax proceeded to help himself to large stashes of silver coins and bullion that the Steeles were keeping on their property in anticipation of a Federal Reserve currency crash brought on by Barack Obama's incompetence. The final whereabouts of that silver seems to be something of a mystery. Apparently, the FBI allowed Fairfax to keep at least some of it as a kind of bonus or reparations for the annoyance and inconvenience of having to spend 16 months in a minimum security prison in the service of the Bureau. The basis of Edgar Steele's conviction were audio files fabricated by FBI technicians, supposedly discussions between himself and Fairfax about murder for hire, which appeared, even to a layman who first heard them, to sound strained, stilted, unnatural, and obviously doctored at the key points and phrases. The Steele tapes were not only forgeries, apparently they weren't even very good ones. At Steele's trial, two international audio engineering experts who were prepared to testify in open court that the tapes were fraudulent were barred from appearing by a corrupt judge. The jury was never allowed to hear evidence which clearly proved Edgar Steele's innocence. The situation wasn't helped by the fact that Steele's first attorney, a federal public defender, was a raging alcoholic who at the time was being sued by three members of his own legal staff for various acts of drunken misconduct. Steele's second defense attorney, a man named Robert McAllister, on whom he and his wife Cindy expended most of their life savings, turned out to be facing disbarment for embezzling clients' money and was in fact disbarred only weeks after Steele's conviction. Many thought at the time that this second attorney may have struck a deal with the government to keep himself out of prison by deliberately taking a dive in the courtroom and bungling Steele's defense. If so, it didn't work. In September of 2012, the 62-year-old McAllister was sentenced to 6 years for fraud, so there's some comfort in hoping that the bent brief may die in the same prison cell as the client he betrayed. For whatever reason, McAllister's performance in the courtroom was lackluster, to say the least, and he refused to put his client on the witness stand, which always looks very bad to a jury. Needless to say, the attorney's own perilous legal situation was never explained to either Ed or Cindy Steele while the trial was going on. As icing on the cake, I've spoken to persons present in the courtroom during the trial who told me that Ed Steele, quote-unquote, looked like a zombie, confused and disoriented, and he seemed completely incoherent and disconnected from what was going on around him. The consensus of opinion was that Steele was drugged on orders from someone in the federal government to make sure that he was incapable of assisting in his own defense or even understanding what was happening to him. No one knows for sure why the federal government of the United States did this horrible thing to Edgar Steele. He must have pissed off somebody really bad, but I don't see how. Ed had withdrawn from the Idaho governor's race due to ill health. I have this horrible suspicion that the whole ghastly business may simply have been some kind of grotesque experiment on the part of the FBI, just to see how far they could go and how much they could get away with in arresting and destroying critics of the regime. Edgar Steele is now being held in the Victorville facility, which is well known throughout the federal system as a kind of toilet where human beings are flushed away. Among other things, the water supply in the prison is known to be contaminated with carcinogens and toxic waste, which facilitates the decline in health of those federal prisoners whom the government wishes to hear no more of. Victorville is notorious as an end-of-the-line destination. Once the gates clang shut there, no one leaves except in a body bag. Edgar Steele has been sent there to die. I'm now going to play for you the third, and I believe the last part of Edgar Steele's prison interview with KXLY-TV in Idaho from November the 3rd, 2011, several weeks before he was sentenced. The last time Steele was allowed to be seen or heard in public before he disappeared into the belly of the beast.
And it is, I will talk about the conspiracy, the corruption, because that's obviously the biggest contention. Where does it start, and how far does it go?
I think it ends up being a combination of personal greed and group political agenda, frankly. And we know what the political agenda is in my case, because I've spoken out against the government. I've written essays where I've just gone right up to the line of advocating violent revolution. But I know where the line is, so I never step over it. Do I believe we should have a violent revolution? Absolutely not. I wouldn't say that, because that would be illegal for me to say that. But we need some change in this country. And you can't change it, and it won't allow you to change it with the systems that were put in place. Remember, it was Thomas Jefferson who said, "The tree of liberty must be watered with the blood of tyrants and patriots alike from time to time." He knew that when the country was set up, that ongoing revolution would keep it honest. We haven't had anything like that. We have a two-party system. That's a joke. Yeah, right. There's a difference between George W. Bush and Barack Obama. Barack Obama comes in promising to get us out of one war and leads us into two others. You know, now we're back to one war again, and he's claiming how much he's done for us. Excuse me, you were supposed to get us out of the first one as a result of us putting you in office. And now he's angling to put us into Syria, it appears, as well as a number of other Middle East countries. There's something wrong in this country.
So when you say personal greed in your case, who is there a person specifically?
Yes. Larry Fairfax stole silver, wanted to cover it up. Okay? Needed to get me out of the way to do that. This FBI agent who has his fingers on these recordings, I don't know who did the recordings. But the odds imply heavily that this FBI agent was involved with them. You know, why did he violate so many FBI protocols in making the recordings? How do you think FBI agents get promoted? You know, there's a North Idaho task force that he's a member of that was formed about 12 to 13 years ago at the time of the Aryan Nations hoo-ha. And they haven't had much to do all these years. There really aren't that many skinheads. And there certainly aren't any violent political dissidents around here. And I'm not one of them either. I absolutely abhor violence and speak out against it. But that task force hasn't had much to do. You know how we always hear about the fireman who sets the fires because he's underemployed or wants to be a hero and get advanced? You think that only happens to firemen? How do you think FBI agents get advanced? This Sotka guy has been caught in lie after lie after lie. I think the chances are pretty good that he had personal greed for being advanced as his motivation. And this all got caught up with group greed on the part of groups like the ADL, the SPLC, maybe the Justice Department. After all, the Justice Department runs the FBI. But then so does the ADL.
Shortly before, I went back and looked at some of your readings, shortly before you were arrested, I wish I had it with me and I don't, but you basically said something big is going to happen. You kind of hinted that I'm about to shake things up.
Oh, I put out an internet message because I've been getting all these messages from my list members complaining that I wasn't being polemic enough in my writings, that I wasn't going after people. And I had gotten a rash of death threats at the same time. And now, I don't know who was behind those. They'd come in by email. They'd come in on my answering machine. But I got annoyed. And then I had this epiphany where I had this aortic aneurysm where I literally died. I died. They brought me back to life. They were operating me in the hospital elevator on the way to the operating room. I see myself coming to an end, and I'm getting people clamoring for me to speak out the way I used to, because I'd quieted down a lot in recent years. And I decided I was going to do that.
And you were speaking out. You were not advocating some sort of a...
Oh, no, absolutely not. I told them in the list message, which is still posted on my website, I'm sure.
Yeah, it is. I saw it.
What I was going to do was return to a former style of writing that I'd had.
How far up does the conspiracy go?
Well, it depends upon which ladder you want to trace. How far does it go up official government ladders? I don't honestly think it goes up too far. You know, it's like the JFK assassination. Most people believe that he was assassinated by somebody other than Lee Harvey Oswald. A lot of people think that it was some elements of the U.S. government and or the Cuban government and or the mafia, and take your pick. I suspect that there was an element of the U.S. government involved, a rogue element of the CIA, which Kennedy had pronounced he wanted to put out of business, or the FBI, or the military, because of that Bay of Pigs fiasco that he wouldn't support and get our people out of when they got in trouble. It may be just organized crime because of Bobby Kennedy going after them as the Attorney General. I don't know, but I think chances are that there were rogue elements of our government. And there always have been those rogue elements. And yes, I think those rogue elements are involved in my case. I think one of those is this FBI agent. And I think, you know, the prosecutors have been remarkably venal, vindictive in this case. And I've looked at it right from the beginning and wondered, what are they so angry about? You know, aren't I innocent until proven? No, you're not innocent until proven guilty. You're guilty until you're not able to prove yourself not guilty. That's the way it really works in America today. They convict all but one out of 212 federal detainees. Did you know that? One out of 212. You know, that's a remarkable approximation of never. Okay? Once you get in the system, you're done for. And I can see how it happens. I've always had my clients tell me that this stuff was going on, but I always thought, well, they were listening in because they want to make sure there are no jailbreaks. Nah, that ain't why they're listening in. They're listening in to record all your conversations with your lawyers, to give copies of those recordings to the prosecutors, like they did in my case, as we have proven. So,
one question I have, though, hearing that is knowing what you know and that you believed that before, is there any different level of care or different approach you can have?
I'm not sure I understand the question exactly. Do I have a different level of care? You bet. I can't believe they're doing this to me. I can't believe what's going on. Everything I've ever heard of, I've seen going on in my case. We are filing today with the U.S. Supreme Court a petition for two writs, prohibition and mandamus, in connection with the feds invading my attorney-client privilege right from day one. They have ruthlessly, repeatedly, doggedly, and with rancor, I think I'd say, opened my mail to lawyers, listened into and recorded my telephone calls to lawyers, listened into my attorney booth confidential meetings with lawyers. Even the judge in my case did. Even the judge during the trial. He had a little secret hearing. There were lots of secret hearings in my case. And all those 29 sidebar conferences in my trial that I was not allowed to attend. And several secret hearings, many secret filed documents that are still sealed. And the only point of these being sealed, as near as I can tell, is that they make the government look bad. That's been the purpose of it. I'd like to have everything in my case unsealed. It should have been unsealed from the beginning. There shouldn't have ever been one closed hearing. And yet, there was a closed hearing before my defense started. My defense, there's a joke, started being put on, in which the judge remonstrated with my lawyer in this sealed hearing that I wasn't allowed to attend, that I wasn't allowed to even know about during my trial, claiming that I had said to him, well, if we need a continuance to get Dr. Papson here, I'll have to explain this now, won't I? Then I can guarantee us 3 days with a medical emergency. Now, I'm alleged to have said that. I probably shouldn't say I admit that I said that, okay? But there's nothing wrong with it. You know, it's like that telephone call to my wife. Listen to the damn call and ask yourself if it really can be taken as attempting to twist a witness or attempting to stand her up to tell the truth. It can go both ways. obviously, because they were able to charge me and convince a jury, but the way it was meant isn't the way it was taken.
The judge, you think the judge is corrupt in this case?
I can't say that. I mean, I'm not allowed to say that. It would literally be illegal for me to say that. Doesn't matter about me being a lawyer. They're already disbarring me in every state I'm admitted in. But I'll tell you this. He's certainly been guilty of several cases of judicial misconduct. There has been reversible error in and outside that trial enough that I'm confident I am going to get a new trial.
That was what I was going to say. If all of these things have taken place and you have ways to prove them, then your motion for a new trial should be...
I can prove them.
But is the same thing going to happen to you, do you think, in a new trial?
I hope not.
Change in the second time around.
We need a new judge. We need a new jury, obviously. We need some new prosecutors whose minds aren't tainted. I mean, my lawyer, the first lawyer I had, the public defender, said to me in anger one day, he says, you might as well tell Tracy Whalen, who's the prosecutor, everything anyway, because she hears about it before I do. And he was talking about my phone calls to these other lawyers I was talking to being bugged.
And that's the contention, right? That because they were not your lawyers of record in this case, they could be listened to.
Well, that is the unwritten policy of the U.S. Marshals Service. U.S. Marshals Service is responsible for prisoner integrity, safety, security. And they are the implementers, the water carriers for the prosecutors who give the orders and who get the copies of the tapes and the letters and the conference recordings. It's astounding. It goes on more in my case, I think, than it does most.
But I mean, as an attorney, you've got to see that side of it. They're not your attorneys of record in the case, so how can it be privileged?
Well, read the Sixth Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. It says that they are. How am I supposed to interview? Look, I was talking to other attorneys to interview to get a new attorney on the case. How am I expected to interview a new attorney if I can't? I mean, I got to discuss the case with them, don't I? And it turned out I've gotten a new attorney on this case twice now. One when I switched from that public defender to the guy who handled the trial, who mishandled the trial. And then after the trial when I got Wes Hoyt to represent me. Now, each time you got to talk to these guys, and it was those two lawyers, McAllister, my trial lawyer, and Hoyt, my current lawyer. It was my conversations with those two lawyers, guys who became my attorneys of record, that they were getting the recordings of. And we've got the proof of it. You know, we've got the proof during the trial because we got the transcript of that secret hearing. You're not allowed to see it, but I've seen it. They accidentally showed it to me is how I even found out the hearing had taken place. Where the judge admits on the record that a U.S. Marshal Service employee had brought that to him. That's remarkable. He shouldn't have listened to it once he realized it was attorney-client privilege, and he shouldn't have used it the way he did against my lawyer because he intimidated him. That was the point at which my lawyer really stood down and absolutely stopped presenting a defense. This is before we got to start presenting a defense, incidentally. That's why my defense took less than a day, such as it was.
Do you wish you would have taken the stand now?
Oh, absolutely. No question in my mind. I wanted to take the stand at the time, and I got talked out of it against my better judgment.
The Supreme Court appeal, which Ed refers to so confidently in this interview, was dismissed without a hearing and without comment several months after this. Steele has been held incommunicado now for almost a year. His mail is either returned without comment from the prison, or else it simply disappears. At one stage, Ed apparently had access to a prison email system called Carlinks, but no one I can find seems to have heard from him in almost 5 months now. I'm still attempting to determine when was the last time anyone physically heard from Edgar J. Steele, either by phone or by letter or by email. The official Edgar J. Steele website hasn't been updated for over a month, and neither has the Facebook page, and it has been many months since either site contained any information regarding Ed's well-being, no letters or communications from him, and no indication that he's responding to anyone. Now, I believe I may know why this is, but once again, I don't want to speak unless I have some kind of confirmation that what I have heard is happening and what I fear may be happening is, in fact, happening. Speaking of tiny little white minorities from obscure parts of the world, when we think of white Africa, we generally think of South Africa or Rhodesia. But there was a third country in what you might call the white bloc back in the old days, Southwest Africa. Southwest was founded as a German colony in 1884 and was seized by the South Africans during World War I. Back when I was in Africa, if memory serves, the white population was about 75,000 people, of whom half or so were German-speaking descendants of the original settlers. When South Africa surrendered and committed suicide in the early 1990s, Namibia was taken over by a communist Kaffir dictator named Nujoma, and the whites were pretty much all slaughtered or driven out of the country. The cattle and crops all died from the breakdown of the water and irrigation system, and from what I can see on the internet, the country is now the usual African nigger basket case. But for almost a century, there was a very distinct Germanic subculture there in the Southwest. And this is a German song from their own bush war in the 1970s. I don't know who sings it, but it's called the Südwestafrika-Lied, the Song of Southwest Africa.
We're still Southwest Africa, and we will remain Southwest Africa. We will never change our name.
And when they ask us why we stay here, we can only say we love Southwest.
Wir lieben Südwest.
On October the 23rd, 2009, Northwest Front comrade Jeff Hughes was murdered in cold blood in Vancouver, British Columbia by the Royal Canadian Mounted Police. The third anniversary of his death will occur next week. Jeff called in a noise complaint to his local police about some Indian drug addicts next door to him in his apartment building who were playing loud music and basically acting like stoned Indians. It was not the first time he'd called the cops on them. When the police appeared this time around 6 o'clock in the morning, he went down to meet them, and as he stepped out the door, a female RCMP officer fired 10 bullets into his body from her automatic pistol. She literally emptied her gun into an unarmed man. Almost 2 years later, the Canadian government spent an entire inquest denying that this was what had happened, and they didn't convince anybody. The female officer who emptied her entire gun into Jeff was transferred to Ontario somewhere, and from what I can determine from an internet search, she was never even publicly named. Case closed. In the interest of accuracy, I need to clarify that although I knew Jeff Hughes for almost 7 years, I never met him personally, much to my regret. We never got the chance. He was barred from entering the United States because of an old criminal record he had from about 26 years ago, and I'm banned from entering Canada because of my novels, which are also banned in Canada, by the way. So we never got to meet, but for many years we communicated regularly, usually every couple of days, by email, chat room, telephone, sometimes by video. Virtually every way you can get to know a man in this day and age without actually being in the same room with him. Most of you are aware of the fact that, on the whole, I don't think much of the internet. After almost 20 years of internet, I think I've developed some skill in detecting when someone is BSing me. Now, I'm sure most of you have some idea of what I mean. Most of us, by now, can judge an internet contact after a fairly short time and tell whether or not they're running some kind of game on us, or they're lying, or just plain full of it. He rang true every time. Now, let me put it to you this way. Jeff Hughes was one of the very few people I've ever met in the white nationalist movement whom nobody ever said anything bad about. And if you know our movement at all, you'll understand how rare that is. Even his Indian neighbors up there on Selby Street, who knew about his National Socialist beliefs, had good things to say about him to the Vancouver media when they came nosing around after he was murdered. Make no mistake, Jeff Hughes was a real loss. He wasn't just one of those useless net Nazis who hang around Stormfront and VNN under an alias, and nobody knows who or where they are or what they do for the cause, if anything. Jeff stood up and resisted. He passed out leaflets and put up stickers and posted all over the internet, and above all, he talked to white people personally about racial reality. And in Canada, that is a deadly dangerous thing for a white man to do. He especially loathed these god-awful human rights tribunals that the Canadian regime uses to suppress and punish dissent and thought crime among white Canadians. And more than once, he rode hundreds of miles on a bus all over BC and Alberta just to sit in the audience when someone was being persecuted and destroyed by these ghastly kangaroo courts, just so there would be at least one friendly face there to support whoever was being victimized by Richard Warman or whatever kike brought the complaint. I could name some of the cases, but even today it's probably not a good idea to associate the names of any individuals with Jeff. One point we need to internalize is that Jeff was already perfectly well known to the RCMP. He was an open nationalist, and he had been visited repeatedly by various kinds of Canadian political police, including a few weeks before he was killed by a man named Sergeant Sean McGowan from the British Columbia Hate Crime Squad, who, according to what I hear, are the Ottawa regime's chief head knockers in the province, in charge of suppressing racial dissent on the part of European Canadians. Based on what Jeff told me about that, it is my personal belief that the possibility cannot be discounted that Jeff was killed for the same reason the FBI attacked and murdered Randy Weaver's family on Ruby Ridge in 1992. Cops hate it when people refuse to become snitches, and they can be very vindictive about it, especially in custodial situations. Right now, the Northwest Front has a woman comrade named Pam Bailey who's being held in solitary confinement, most likely for the next 2 years until her sentence ends, due to a pattern of official harassment based on her refusal to become an informant. Ironically, she and Jeff were corresponding when he was murdered. Police and prison officers hate worse than anything to be told to piss off when they order somebody to rat out. It challenges their authority and their petty self-esteem almost as much as an assault. Like all bullies, they tend to freak out when anybody stands up to them. The upshot of all this is that Jeff's address had to be red flagged, or whatever the Canadian term is for it. The RCMP had to know who was in that apartment. Another thing, in Canada, there are local police departments just like there are down here. Now, according to the official version, the original call from Jeff's building was allegedly a noise complaint about some Indian dopers playing loud rap music. And yet it was the almighty horsemen themselves who showed up. A full RCMP response team, including a dog team, shows up at 6 o'clock in the morning for a domestic noise complaint. Yeah, right. Now, down here in the States, you don't send the FBI or the SWAT team to respond to domestic dispute calls, unless the cops know that there's most likely something a lot heavier going to go down. So that whole business of the RCMP rocking up at 6 in the morning looks excessive, looks more like a dawn raid to me. As I mentioned earlier, in the summer of 2011, there was an inquest, almost 2 years after Jeff's murder, which I won't discuss because there's no point. It is such palpable bullshit. The Canadian government investigated itself and cleared itself. Big surprise there. One more thing I'd like to get into. Now, there's something that angers me and disturbs me about all this almost as much as Jeff's actual death, although it may sound a bit irrelevant. Now, those of you who were on the Northwest Revolution email list during that period of time will probably remember a number of appeals from both Jeff Hughes and myself down through the years, practically getting down on our knees and begging some of our Canadian comrades to step forward, to make the move to Western Canada and the Vancouver area in particular, and help Jeff with his work for the NF. No one ever responded. Now, Jeff had Canadian comrades, of course, all of whom liked and respected him, but they were scattered all over this huge country, and his nearest friends were several hours away. Sound familiar? It's a situation a lot of us deal with. Now, after he was murdered, one of Jeff's neighbors posted a more or less eyewitness account of the whole incident to Stormfront, which is how we know certain details of the actual murder. For example, the inquest claimed that Jeff Hughes was killed in his apartment with one shot, while the local witnesses heard multiple shots, and both they and the media saw him, even photographed him, lying dead on the ground outside. Now, in view of the fact that Stormfront is Richard Warman's happy hunting ground, for this guy to post what he saw probably required a bit of courage. And don't get me wrong, I appreciate this person's coming forward. But the fact is that after all of this time begging and pleading for someone local to step forward and help Jeff, or even move to the Canadian Northwest homeland itself to help him, it turns out that Jeff had a fellow white nationalist living right across the street from him the whole time, and yet they never even knew of one another's existence. Now, the same thing applies to all of us. We all complain about the isolation of being a lone nationalist in a sea of political correctness, and yet, for all we know, we could have half a dozen comrades living within a couple of miles of us. It's this damned internet. We simply aren't using it right. We should be using it as a means of communication and a way to level the playing field against the Jewish and state-controlled liberal media. And we finally seem to be making some headway with that, but all too often we use it as a place to hide from each other. And we have to stop that. We have to put the brakes on this rampant paranoia and just plain laziness that keeps us from getting together in the real physical world. All too many of us use the white internet as a kind of online role-playing game, like some kind of racist World of Warcraft. We use all these strange email handles and identities on V-bulletin boards like we were hobbits or something. We end up living in a fantasy world that gives the white man a feel-good factor which he doesn't need and which is very bad for him. We sit all evening behind the computer playing on V-bulletin boards, tapping away or yakking away on Skype or whatever, and then at the end of the evening we log off with the feeling that we actually got something accomplished, and usually that's simply not true. The internet, as white people use it, is politically sterile. It produces nothing but more internet, nothing in the real world. There is no conceivable substitute for real human beings doing real things in the real world, and we have to drag ourselves kicking and screaming out of cyberspace and get back into the real world because we are running out of time. There is a line in the Horst Wessel song, Kameraden, die Rotfront und Reaktion geschossen, marschieren im Geist in unser Reihen mit. Comrades murdered by communist and reactionary both, march in spirit by our side. So does Jeff Hughes.
The fleet-foot hosts of men who come with faces won from Fong's Fair and from Fisher's Cut along the banks of land. They come with vengeance in their eyes. Too late are they. For young Roddy McCauley goes to die on the bridge of Toon today. Up the narrow street he stepped, smiling proud and young. About the hemp-rope on his neck, the golden ringlets clung. There was never a tear. Young Roddy McCauley goes to die on the bridge of Doom today. When he last stepped up that street, shining pipe in hand, around him up in grim array, a star-wide furnace band. For Runton Town, for Runton Town, he led them to the fray. As young Roddy McCauley goes to die on the bridge of Doom today. There is nary a one of all your dead who bravely fell in fray. Men he who marches to his death on the bridge of Doom today. As young Roddy McCauley goes to die on the bridge of Doom today.
Damn, I'm running long already. Okay, let me wind up with a few odds and ends. There's been some email back and forth disputing my presidential pick now that Romney seems to be surging ahead, and a Gallup poll today puts Mittens ahead of the O-Man 51% to 45%. It could be that my speculation last week that the real power structure, the faceless men in the suits, have taken a good long look at what's likely to happen over the next 4 years, as well as the still extreme likelihood of an Israeli attack against Persia sometime in the future, and they've decided to change horses in midstream. I noticed that several articles have hinted that the niggers are threatening to riot if Barry and his hoe aren't returned to 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. Well, maybe, but I tell you what, at this point, after much cogitation, I'm still going to have to go with Obama. My reason is simple. Obongo is a Democrat, and what do Democrats excel at? Vote fraud. Always have. It's what they do. And then there's that damned electoral college system to be gotten around. And I repeat, all Obongo has to get are about 8 states, and he's over the top with the 270 votes needed to win. He's already got Illinois and New York and California completely sewed up, so that's 104 right there. Since a corrupt Democrat judge in Pennsylvania struck down the voter photo ID law, and that means every nigger in the state will be voting 3 or 4 times, I think we can give him Pennsylvania's 20. That's 124. I'm sorry to say that Seattle and Portland will swing him Washington and Oregon's 19 votes between them, so that's 123. I just don't see how the remaining whites in Michigan are going to outvote that jungle in Detroit, so that's 16 more electoral votes for 139. The New England bloc of Massachusetts, New Hampshire, Vermont, Maine, and Rhode Island, which I think we can really treat as a separate state, always goes blue no matter how they vote locally. And yes, I know Romney was governor of Massachusetts, but I think that was kind of a fluke. So I think we can pretty much give another 26 votes to Obama for a total of 149 electoral votes. And the niggers and the government workers in Maryland and D.C., which again I think need to be taken as kind of a block, will give him 13 more. That's 162. Now that's Obama's rock-solid baseline vote. Beyond that is where it gets dodgy. Watch for serious Democrat vote fraud and diddling in Florida, Ohio, Wisconsin, New Jersey, Virginia, Nevada, which is Harry Reid's territory, North Carolina, which I can tell you is one of the most quietly but viciously corrupt states in the Union, Missouri, i.e. Kansas City and St. Louis, basically anywhere that there are large cities bulging with minorities where voting machines and ballot boxes can be fiddled and the big cities can outvote the much more thinly populated white areas in the countryside. Now, true, I think this one will go down to the wire, but I'm still going with Obama on this one. And once again, let me say that I really do hope I'm wrong on this. A Romney administration will be hideous, but at least we won't have to look at those two ghastly niggers everywhere anymore. And it will be so wonderful to hear liberals like Arianna Huffington and Jon Stewart and Rachel Maddow and the entire staff of NPR scream and scream and scream. So for that reason alone, I really do hope I'm wrong. Quick email from Joanne in Chicago. Dear HAC, I see what you mean about adolescent girls and vampires. My 13-year-old daughter has discovered Twilight, and I think it's messing up her mind and taking her away from reality. Yeah, that's it. Vampires seem to be the fantasy of choice for young white girls, like World of Warcraft and video games are for white boys. I don't watch TV or have cable, but I do keep up, and I notice there is an immense amount of supernatural escapism on the tube over the past 5 or 6 years. In fact, one series is called just that, Supernatural, with two white guys rolling around the country in a classic car, killing werewolves and fighting ghosts and demons and vampires. Yeah. There's a new series that I've watched a few episodes of on my computer called Grimm, largely because it's filmed in Portland and you get to see some homeland scenery in it. And it's the same kind of thing, but the supernatural cop character is allegedly a descendant of the Grimm brothers, and he fights all kinds of Germanic demons and mythological beasts, which is a little bit of a twist. I quit watching, though, when it introduced the mandatory race mixing. I think all this crap got started in earnest about 13, 14 years ago with the Harry Potter craze, and also with Buffy the Vampire Slayer with its Jewish heroine. And by the by, it's not just teenagers that are into all this escapism. There's also vampires for adults. Salon Magazine, the big left liberal website, reviews a lot of this mess. And there's apparently a vampire series now called True Blood that features all kinds of homo vampires and lesbian demons and stuff. As bad as it is, and as bad as Hollywood and the liberals are abusing it, the underlying pathology here is simple and humanly understandable. Basically, Barack Obama's America is such an absolutely shitty place for white people that they will accept anything that offers them any kind of escape from this filthy world that the Jews and the liberals have created, even if it's only for a few hours. White people of both genders are growing up in a completely unnatural world, and they have no natural outlets or allowable, politically acceptable outlets for their racial personality. And so they start turning to, well, vampires. And since we're now almost all rootless and unstable and dysfunctional people, thanks to the past century of Kike rule, many of us just go overboard with it. We become obsessed with it, especially where the internet's involved, and we start to live more in the escapist fantasy than in the real world because the fantasy horror show is better than the real one that we wake up to every morning, which may be part of the enemy's reasoning behind doing this. After all, if people are more concerned about what's happening to their favorite vampire or vampire slayer in the fantasy world they flee into every night on the computer or the TV, then they can't be bothered to pay attention to what Barack Obama and Benjamin Netanyahu are doing, or whether or not they've got a job and a house to live in that hasn't been foreclosed, or whether their kids are turning into little sociopaths because they've got two working parents who don't get home until 7 o'clock at night, etc., etc. You guys have to live in this, so I'm sure you get the idea. Now, here's a thought. Suppose we give young white kids some place to escape to other than the television and the computer and the Jewish crap that's provided for them there. Why can't teenage white boys fantasize about being Northwest Volunteers and killing niggers and spics and fatpos instead of dragons and ogres on a computer screen? Why can't they fantasize about Rooney and Nightshade and Kiki McGee instead of Xena the Warrior Princess? Why can't romantic adolescent white girls dream of being carried off by brooding, Byronic Northwest freedom fighters instead of vampires? Now, we've got the whole Northwest novel series to provide a baseline, and it's true that sitting down and reading a long book can't compete with the actual sound and motion of an electronic screen. I get that, but I understand that animatronic hologram computer software is already available that can give us at least some access to that kind of production if anyone will ever commit to learning it. And in fact, it's already being used to produce cyber porn, video games, and other animation films with no human actors at all. Think, people, think. We need to figure out a way to turn what the racial enemy has done to us back against them. As cliche as this is, we need to start thinking outside the box until such time comes as we can throw the box down and smash it on the concrete.
Radio Free Northwest is brought to you by the Northwest Front. P.O. Box 2188, Bremerton, Washington, 98310. You can visit the party on our website at northwestfront.org. Until next week, comrades, hail victory.
Still is beating heart in my hopes burning new. Who could follow in their footsteps of the rising of the moon? Of the rising of the moon, of the rising of the moon. Who would follow in their footsteps of the rising of the moon?
Come on.